want to go, I could arrange it. You might make it in time for the last push. How about it?
So Jamie was on a ship. And the next morning he was on a landing craft, chugging through the layer of clear air between the low fog and silver water. And then he was on a dismal gray beach, cratered from shelling. A sleeping bag and food and extra socks were in his backpack. Over one shoulder he had a small satchel with his pencils and notebook and watercolors. And over the other he carried a rifle and ammunition. Three tractors were waiting on the sand. He helped load them with supplies, then followed on foot with eight other men. They walked for hours. The truck and tractors outdistanced them, but the tracks were easy to follow. Once he tried to sketch, but he was told it wasn't safe to stop. Better keep moving. Eventually, the rear lines came into sight. A colony of peaked tents pitched amid mud and sphagnum moss on a sloping valley floor, snow-streaked peaks above. Scattered bodies of Japanese soldiers began to appear beside the road, limbs at strange angles, sometimes just a helmet atop a crumpled mass. In the bivouac area, Jamie found a lieutenant in charge of a company of engineers and explained that he was a combat artist.
"Something new every day," said the man, and wished to go to the front. He was told there wasn't really anywhere to go at the moment. The forward groups were holding their positions. "Make yourself at home," the lieutenant said, making a sweeping gesture toward the tents. "Sample the many delights of Attu."
In the evening, not far away, Japanese soldiers drank sake in gulps. They'd been on the tundra for a year and were low on supplies. For a time, there was almost only night. Now, there was almost only day. Always, there was fog. The terrible wind. The colonel in charge had decided against surrender. The Americans' defenses in the valley were light, but beyond, they had a battery of howitzers on a hillside. If the colonel could seize those, he could turn them back on the Americans. The plan was desperate, almost impossible. But an attempt would be an honorable course. 1,000 men were left. They jumped up and down, screaming and stamping the soil. Pistols were pressed into the hands of the wounded, who, as instructed, shot themselves in the head. Those who couldn't were dispatched with injections of morphine or, when patients ran out, grenades. They drank more, everything they could find. At dawn, the colonel ordered them to break for the American lines. Screams woke Jamie. A man near him was bayoneted where he lay, but Jamie was overlooked. He struggled from his sleeping bag, ran uphill with his rifle, away from the chaos. Grenades sent up sprays of earth. He half fell into a foxhole already occupied by the body of a long-dead Japanese soldier. Three Japanese, not far away, cut the guy lines of the medical tent. The canvas fell, draped over thrashing bodies on cots. The soldiers started bayoneting. Later, Jamie would remember the tormented dog from so long ago, under the blanket. But he thought of nothing as he brought up his rifle and took aim. The first one he got in the back of the head. The man's body jerked forward as though yanked by a ripcord. The second he caught in the shoulder, spinning him down into a crouch. While he was kneeling, one hand over the wound, Jamie hit him in the chest. The third man was looking around, confused. Jamie saw that his only weapon was a bayonet tied to a stick. And he dropped this, stood there gazing at the mountains, until Jamie's next shot pierced his forehead. Jamie set aside his rifle. He took a small notebook and a pencil from his chest pocket. His hand shook badly. After a time, the Japanese seemed to lose their sense of purpose and moved in short, erratic bursts like minnows, brandishing weapons at nothing. A few ate rations taken from the dead, wolfing down chocolate bars. They passed around packs of cigarettes, lit up. From uphill came the sounds of continued battle, but the men on the valley floor stood in casual clumps as though at a party. They took grenades from their belts, tapped them against their helmets to start the fuses, held them under their chins or against their stomachs. Quick blasts of gore, smoke like a magician's screen, revealing as it dissipated that bodies recently whole and alive made headless and handless or scooped out at the middle. In the foxhole, Jamie drew and drew, would only realize later that he had covered pages with garbled scribbles and blotches out of which no sense could be made. Ratcliffe Hall, Leicestershire, England, March 1943, 2 months before the Battle of Attu. One long, too long, one short, too long. TMW. Tomorrow. Marion in bed imagined Ruth in her identical bed on the other side of the wall, one finger tapping. Tomorrow. London. Dinner with Ed. Please. Want you to. No more tapping. Had Ruth fallen asleep? Or forgotten her Morse? Marion pressed her palm against the cold plaster, waited. Finally, she tapped with her index finger. To what? A reply. To know him. In January, when Marion had arrived at Ratcliffe Hall, she had learned it was called a great house, not a mansion or a palace. There was one other woman pilot billeted there, an English girl, and three men, two of whom were American. But Marion, daunted by the grand surroundings and the rapid chatter of the others, kept to herself. She was given one of several rooms over the garage, all of which had the luxuries of radiators and hot water. There were tennis courts, and what she learned were squash courts. There was a butler who cleaned the pilot's boots, and dinner was served in a wood-paneled dining room, accompanied with wine and ale. Occasionally, illustrious friends of their host, Sir Lindsay Everard, appeared at the table without warning. Sir Lindsay was heir to a brewing fortune, and owned a nearby aerodrome he'd given over to the ATA. He was not a pilot himself, but an enthusiast, a collector of pilots and airplanes, who seemed delighted the war had brought so many of each to his doorstep. The aerodrome was crowded with a shifting assortment of most everything the RAF flew, though Marion, not yet qualified to fly all the types, mostly flew taxi planes and cleared Spitfires churned out by the factory at Castle Bromwich. Less frequently, she picked up Oxfords from ANSI and Defiance from Wolverhampton and flew to and from maintenance units in the Cotswolds. Or at least she did these things in theory, as the dense industrial haze that hung over the Midlands grounded the pilots many, perhaps most, mornings. Sometimes 3 whole days might pass when they couldn't fly, even as increasingly urgent messages came from Castle Bromwich about all the shiny new spits piling up. On the days Marion flew deliveries, if she finished before dark, a taxi plane might bring her back to Ratcliffe, or she might return via train, or she might have to find lodgings wherever she was, which was not always easy or even possible. It wasn't rare for her to find herself lugging her overnight bag and parachute through closed-up, unfamiliar little towns, looking for a place to sleep. One February night, grimy from delivering a spit to Bryce Norton and another from there to Cosford, Marion returned to Ratcliffe and noticed the door to the next room standing open. She peeked in. A woman leaned over a partially unpacked suitcase. Marion stopped, elation surging up before she could tamp it down. Ruth, she said. Ruth straightened, coolly unsmiling, a dress in her hand. They said you were in the next room. I asked if there was anywhere else, but there isn't. You'll have to blame the ATA. She'd asked for Hamble, not Ratcliffe, she said. She was taking the place of the English girl who'd gone to upgrade to twin engines. Don't worry, I won't get underfoot.
I'm glad you're here, Marion said helplessly.
She hadn't been aware of being unhappy, but her burst of joy at seeing Ruth felt like a relief, an antidote.
I don't know what to say to that, Ruth said, hanging the dress in her wardrobe with a clatter. You dropped me completely.
I'm sorry. I really am.
Are you? Being sorry's all well and good, but I think you owe me an explanation.
Marion hesitated. She couldn't tell Ruth the truth, but she didn't want to lie.
Could you trust me enough to forgive me, even if I don't explain?
You're right, I behaved badly.
There's a reason, but could you trust that it doesn't matter?
Again, Ruth looked her over, gauging her sincerity.
We'll see.
They were awkward for a few days, but then they were as they'd been in the beginning. Better, even, more grateful for each other. Ruth had been lonely too, she said. The Ratcliffe dinner table was dramatically enlivened by Ruth's presence. She dove headlong into the conversation, and when, a week into her residency, ski planes came up, Marion suspected Ruth had somehow steered the conversation toward them, she said,
Marion, tell them about taking off from the mud flats.
And what could Marion do but describe herself rocking from side to side in her old Belanca, trying to unstick the skis from the stinking muck at Valdez?
Why did you have the skis on at all if there was no snow?
Sir Lindsay wanted to know. She explained about bringing supplies to the high mines, landing on glaciers even in the summer. And Sir Lindsay's interest was so apparent, his questions so probing, leading her inexorably from one anecdote to the next, that she scarcely noticed she was behaving almost as a raconteur, holding the whole table rapt. Though when she finally hit a patch of astonished silence after describing a willy-waw blowing her off a glacier, she clammed up, embarrassed, sawed fixedly at her meat. Sir Lindsay turned to Ruth.
You've unlocked our sphinx, he said. Well done.
Marion had been avoiding meeting Eddie, had ducked other invitations from Ruth, but never a direct plea until the Morse code message came through the wall. Until then, if Ruth said Eddie would be in London, Marion would beg off, ride her motorbike alone to Leicester or Nottingham or elsewhere. If Ruth said Eddie couldn't get away, Marion would go into town with her, and they would stay at the Red Cross Club, and all would be as it had been. Dinners, movies and plays, cocktails, dancing. But Marion couldn't refuse. Bomber crews didn't have much in the way of life expectancy. She lifted her finger, tapped okay. Eddie met them at the Savoy. Marion gave his hand a firm shake, looked him in the eye. He was very tall and had a long rectangular head like a cart horse's, and warm eyes under heavy brows. Though his teeth were long and a little crowded, he showed them unreservedly when he smiled.
I've been wanting to be friends with you for a long time, he said. Ruth doesn't usually rave about people.
You'll give her a swollen head, Ruth said, leaning on his arm.
Before the war, Eddie said as he steered them to the American bar. I never would have dared come into this hotel because I would have been worried about looking like a hayseed, but the way I see it, if I can fly over Germany, I can drink anywhere I want. He indicated his olive jacket, his silver navigator's wings. It helps not having to worry about what to wear. Marion nodded. Her own blue uniform felt like armor, too, like a universal explanation. Ruth poked her in the back.
You'll have to talk tonight, Marion, or Eddie will think I've been telling tall tales.
I know what you mean, Marion said to Eddie, thinking of Jackie scolding her for wearing flying clothes to her interview.
It's a relief to be above reproach.
Above reproach, Eddie said. That's exactly it.
You know, I almost don't want to admit how much I've been enjoying London. The mood is exuberant, isn't it? I want to say careening. Do you know what I mean?
I guess when people are being reminded all the time they might die, they will die, they make more of an effort to be alive. Don't you think?
They ordered cocktails, and Eddie told a story about his ball turret gunner falling asleep as they approached a target, curled in his steel and plexiglass bubble under the B-17's belly.
I don't know how you sleep like that, dangling in the sky, but this guy can sleep anywhere. He's famous for it.
Marion can sleep anywhere, too, said Ruth.
Eddie raised an eyebrow.
That so? What's your secret? I'm a terrible sleeper.
Keep going with the story, Marion said.
Well, we didn't know he was asleep, only that he was being real quiet.
He said he didn't wake up until the flak was really going, and then he... Eddie mimicked someone lurching and blinking awake, swiveled around and immediately shot down a Messerschmitt. We got back in one piece, one slightly perforated piece, and he said he'd been having a dream about shooting down an airplane, and as soon as he woke up, it came true. He leaned forward, amused, looking between Marion and Ruth. Isn't that strange?
I'll tell you, we all thought hard about what we wanted to dream about before we went to sleep that night, in case it was contagious. Dreams coming true.
I hope you dreamed about waking up at an airbase in England, Ruth said. Charming. That was the word for him. Marion had met so few charming people, at least not whose charm was of Eddie's easy, generous, affable variety. She could see, watching Ruth watch Eddie, that she loved him.
Marion could fall asleep in a ball turret if she wanted to, Ruth said.
Eddie asked,
What's the most unlikely place you've ever slept, Marion?
Marion looked at Ruth, who waited expectantly, wanting her to impress, to dazzle. She felt defeated already. She could never compete with Eddie's charm. Still, she resolved not to be dull. Once, she said, in Alaska, I crashed a plane into a river, deep enough that there was water in the cockpit. There was no chance of help until the next morning, so I slept on top of the plane. She hunched her shoulders, losing momentum. It was summer. It wasn't too bad, except for the mosquitoes.
Tell him about the bear, Ruth said.
A bear came by, Marion said miserably, fishing.
A grizzly bear, said Ruth.
Were you always brave? Eddie said. What were you like as a child?
Marion thought. Naive, she said. Boyish. Obsessive. Eddie smiled broadly. They went to dinner at a Greek restaurant.
There's something shocking about the scale, Eddie said about Greenland, over which he'd navigated a brand new B-17 when he came from the States. All you can see is ice, white to the horizon. My maps might as well have been empty pages.
Marion was run through by deep envy. She envied him Ruth, and she envied him Greenland. She remembered the etchings of icebergs and whaling ships in her father's books. Once, she said, I flew north from Barrow, at the very top of Alaska, out over the ice pack. I almost couldn't make myself turn back. There was something... She trailed off. She didn't know what she wanted to say.
Mesmerizing, he said. I found the blankness mesmerizing.
Yes, she said. That's what it was.
Marion always pushes too far, said Ruth. She can't help herself. Anyway, all that ice sounds awful to me. There aren't even any people there.
There are some around the edges, Eddie said. Must be hardy folk.
No people is part of the appeal, said Marion. Eddie lifted his glass.
To no people.
Leaving the restaurant, they plunged into the blackout as though dropping into an underwater cave. Piccadilly deprived the eye but crowded the other senses. Bodies pushed from all around. Soldiers and women hooted and laughed, wheeling past like bats. To Marion, tethered to Ruth by the hand, the noise and movement and hilarity seemed like another form of stillness, of waiting. They were all waiting. For the liquor to kick in, for a kiss or a touch, for dawn, for sleep, for duty to resume, for the war to go on, to end if it ever would, for what would happen to happen. Eddie steered them through a door and a dark velvet membrane of blackout curtains into a humid bubble of life. Masked uniforms shifted and bobbed on a dance floor like a raft of kelp on a swell, dappled with colored lights. Under the smoke, the air had a sweet and sour funk, like the people themselves were fermenting. On stage, horns glinted, violins dipped and parried. A singer knit his brow and clutched the microphone as though the song were being dragged out of him by an unseen claw. They went up to the balcony. Eddie was describing the view from his navigator's desk, out a bomber's plexiglass nose.
Sometimes it's like a rose window in a cathedral, he shouted over the band as they slid into a banquette. And sometimes it's a portal into hell.
A roundel of sky and cloud. Puffs of flak bursting from nothing, like black popcorn. Hundreds of bombers in formation, planes transforming into masses of smoke and flames. Sometimes one would fall, burning onto another. It got so cold in the planes, their skin stuck to the instruments. They wore so many layers of clothes and gear, they were big as boulders. Water passed below, thin beaches or marshy coast. Then the geometry of human life, fields, roads, roofs. Onto these, they dropped bombs. There were real eggs for breakfast rather than powdered ones on days they flew. Ruth, between them on the curved banquette, lolled against Marion's shoulder. Why, Marion wondered, did Ruth not lean against Eddie instead? A few times on winter days, she had gone with Caleb and Jamie to the hot springs near Missoula, and the sensation of being submerged in warmth while her cheeks burned with cold and her eyes teared from wind was not unlike how she felt now, most of her basking in the pleasure of Ruth's closeness while her extremities remained exposed to Eddie's frigid band of sky.
Enough, Eddie said, interrupting himself. Marion, I've been wondering, how did you get it into your head to fly?
I just wanted to. That's how it is for most everyone, isn't it?
There must have been something.
The barnstormers, Ruth prodded her. Yes, she said, reluctant. I did meet some barnstormers when I was a kid.
The same day Lindbergh flew the Atlantic, Ruth said. Destiny.
She signaled a waitress for another round.
Then what? Eddie said.
Ordinarily, this was a question Marion would dodge. The facts of her life seemed too strange to tell, too steeped in shame and consequence, and she wasn't sure she could adequately explain herself. But for once, she didn't want to retreat or evade. In the midst of a war, her secrets were inconsequential. She said, even as a kid, I knew I needed to make money to be a pilot, so I cut my hair off and dressed as a boy so I'd get hired to do odd jobs.
Were people fooled?
Some were. Some people never looked closely at all, at anything. And I think some preferred not to look too closely. Also, it wasn't so unusual in Montana for people to live on the fringes. She told them about collecting bottles, about driving for Mr. Stanley, about Wallace and his drinking and gambling. Then a man came along who offered to pay for flying lessons. Eddie looked puzzled.
Why?
It turned out he wanted to marry me.
How'd you get out of that one? Asked Ruth.
Marion forced herself to meet Ruth's eye. I didn't. I married him, eventually.
You married him?
Ruth said, drawing back, outraged and transfixed.
You told me you'd never even gotten close to marrying anyone.
I lied, Marion said. I don't talk about him. He wasn't a very nice man. She watched the dancers below. She and Barclay had only danced once, on the crossing to England for their honeymoon. In general, he had disdained dancing. But the night the storm abated, he'd led her to the ballroom after dinner. The floor had risen and fallen under their feet with the swell, like someone breathing. He's dead now, anyway, she said.
But who was he?
Demanded Ruth. Marion said nothing. How could she explain Barclay? Eddie's warm, mournful eyes lingered on Marion.
We've interrogated Marion enough. Now we should dance.
He stood and held out a hand to Marion.
So you're both going to abandon me? Ruth said. The drinks haven't come yet.
Ruthie, for as long as I've known you, you've never had a problem finding someone to dance with,
Eddie said. Out in the night again, Marion turned to say a quick goodbye to Ruth and Eddie, to flee from the sight of them going off together. But the brief, flaring glow of someone's cigarette lighter caught them embracing. Not kissing, but holding each other tightly. The lighter snapped closed. The murk swallowed them. Ruth called her name.
I'm here, Marion said.
Where?
Right here.
Ruth had her by the arm.
Let's go. I hate goodbyes.
Why aren't you going with him?
Do you want me to?
I don't understand.
I don't understand why you lied about being married.
They walked a little way down the street in the general direction of the Red Cross Club.
Don't you love him? Marion asked.
It seems like you do.
Of course I do. He's Eddie. What's not to love? Didn't you love your husband?
Dawn was soaking through the cloud. Shapes were coalescing, different grades of shadow. At the end, I hated him.
But in the beginning?
Maybe in the beginning.
You could have just told me you were married, Ruth said. You're not so special that everything has to be a secret.
I don't think I'm special.
Ruth let out a derisive snort.
You do so. And that's why you know you can drop people and they'll still come back.
You were right, too. I came crawling as soon as you snapped your fingers.
That's not it at all.
Tell me, then.
Why won't you answer me about Eddie? Don't you sleep together?
Why do you care, Marion?
Oh. In the dimness, Ruth tripped over the outstretched leg of a soldier passed out on the sidewalk and lurched down hard onto her hands and knees.
Oh,
Marion echoed. She knelt beside Ruth. Are you all right? Ruth sat up, shaking out her hands.
Yes, but it stings.
The drunk hadn't moved, and Ruth poked his leg. He stirred, curling up.
Guess he's not dead, she said.
We should move so no one does the same to you. Marion took Ruth's arm, hoisting her up. They sat in a doorway on a low granite step. Marion caught the smell of urine from somewhere, and of smoke and morning damp. Ruth's palms were raw and gritty, her stockings torn at the knees and streaked with blood. Gently, Marion took Ruth's hand, turned it over, and kissed her knuckles. She felt like a spitfire held too long on the ground. She needed to move, to act, or she would boil over.
It's not like that with Eddie and me, Ruth said. We do love each other.
But we're different. We don't... It's not romantic between us. Sometimes it's easier to be married because married people seem like everyone else. No one asks questions, or not as many. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
I think so, Marion said, and she teetered for a final moment before she leaned over and kissed Ruth, who kissed back without hesitation. It was an ordinary kiss in some ways, the wetness of a mouth, the blindness. A two-note whistle broke them apart. An American airman swayed by, leering bemusedly.
Room for me?
Not even a little, Ruth said. Go home.
Come on, girls, be nice.
Marion got to her feet, pulling Ruth with her. As they hurried down the street holding hands, Ruth gasped as though she'd suddenly remembered something.
What? Said Marion.
Ruth lifted the hand Marion was holding, scraped from her fall.
You're hurting me.
Marion had been squeezing without realizing it.
I'm sorry.
She kissed the knuckles again.
It's getting light,
Ruth said, gently reclaiming her hand.
People will see.
Ratcliffe Hall, Leicestershire, England, April 1943. 1 month after Marion met Eddie, 1 month before the Battle of Attoo.
Have you heard about the night witches?
Ruth asked, lying on her back in bed at Ratcliffe Hall. Marion shook her head. She was wedged between Ruth and the wall, propped on an elbow, her other hand stroking Ruth's belly under the blankets.
Russian girls and old biplanes, Ruth said. They have a whole regiment of them. They fly over German lines at night and drop bombs by hand. They cut their engines and glide in, whoosh, in the dark, like a broomstick passing over. Of course, they get killed like crazy.
At least they're doing something useful.
So are we.
Mostly, I sit around waiting for the weather to clear.
This is useful, Ruth said as she pushed Marion's hand downward.
Maybe we're night witches, too.
Marion smiled, pulled her hand back up. They called me a witch in Alaska as a joke, because I could get where I wanted even in bad weather. But she was thinking of Barclay, too, how he'd half believed her when she'd claimed to have cast a spell on her womb.
It just means they were scared of you.
Maybe. Her thumb brushed the underside of Ruth's breast, and Ruth lifted her ribs encouragingly. Do you think any of the other ATA girls do this?
Yes. Well, I don't know. I could name a couple who'd certainly like to, whether they know it or not.
Ruth had been smiling but turned serious. It's so expected for girls to like men that most of them never stop to think if they really do. Wasn't that how it was for you? She waited, beseechingly, for Marion to agree. She seemed unable to stop herself from seeking reassurances that Marion hadn't enjoyed sleeping with men, or at least that she preferred sleeping with Ruth.
I guess, Marion said.
Sort of.
There's always been girls like us hidden in the nooks and crannies.
I don't know exactly what kind of girl I am, Marion said.
She had trouble with that word, girl, but woman didn't feel quite right either, applied to herself. Being a woman seemed to suggest a person who owned baking pans and a string of pearls.
People make assumptions. Did I tell you the name of my high school?
Our Lady of the Assumption.
You did. The nuns only ever told us it was a sin to let boys touch us. They never said anything about girls. She sounded amused and spiteful. It seems to me you knew yourself better from the beginning than most people ever do.
Maybe, Ruth said. But some of that's just being headstrong.
Ruth had told Marion she'd known from childhood she preferred women. She'd been a wily little thing, canny enough to keep her mouth shut and start figuring out how to get what she wanted without being run out of her little Catholic parish in her little Michigan town with pitchforks. Did Eddie always know too? For Marion had finally come to understand the nature of Ruth's marriage.
I wouldn't want to speak for him.
A silence.
Think how much had to happen for you and me to meet.
Well, Marion said, there had to be a war.
And of course, this completely justifies that.
Ruth, full of dark laughter, had let her voice get loud, and Marion shushed her. They looked at each other, listening, but no sound came from the other rooms above the garage.
They wouldn't think anything of me being in here anyway, Ruth said in a whisper. Just two gals having a late-night chat.
This was true. In the month since their first kiss, every night they'd both been at Ratcliffe, they'd wound up in one or the other of their beds. The visitor had to return to her own room at some point. A maid brought tea in the mornings, but so far no one had seemed to notice anything. Once, by a stroke of good luck, they'd been caught out together the same night in Lossiemouth and had found a pub whose dour proprietress had informed them brusquely that, "You'll have to share a room. It'll be cozy, I'm afraid."
"I suppose we can manage," Ruth had said, "if we must."
There was glee to be taken from the subterfuge, from the world's lack of imagination. And Ruth showed her how to take it, though Marion knew that for Ruth there was also bitterness at the necessity of secrecy. People had begun asking them if they were sisters, even though they looked nothing alike. Ruth, short and buxom and dark, Marion, tall, narrow, and fair.
"They're picking up on our closeness," Ruth said. "But they don't know what to make of it, so they draw the only conclusion they can think of."
"Yes," Ruth always said, "we're sisters." Not that Marion could imagine wanting to flout their relationship. She didn't wish she could write to Jamie and tell him she was in love, because no part of her wanted to face his surprise, his consternation. She didn't think he would berate her for being immoral. As an artist, he knew all types. But she thought he would be uncomfortable in a way that would wear a groove between them. The groove would deepen and widen into a chasm bigger than the immense wedge of the planet that already separated them. He wouldn't be able to keep from imagining what she and Ruth did together, and she feared that revulsion would inevitably creep in, grow on his idea of her like mildew. She wouldn't say she'd discovered a firm preference for women, but neither would she now confidently say that she preferred men. In this moment, she would choose Ruth over anyone, but still she missed, a little bit, the inherent imbalance of power she'd felt with a man, the momentum toward submission, toward breaching, the demanding solidity of a cock. She tried not to let herself think about Barclay. After him, with other men, even Caleb, he'd reverberated in her like an echo. Sometimes only faintly, sometimes as violently and shockingly as a gunshot in a canyon thought to be empty. With Ruth, though, no echoes intruded. With Ruth, the act was more egalitarian, and surprisingly, in some ways, more carnal, driven by a grasping sort of resourcefulness. A blind determination to merge. The first few times they were together, Marion hadn't put her mouth on Ruth. But when she finally did, she'd found saltiness, pungency, flesh inside flesh, a rawness unlike anything on a man's body. Her own clitoris, as much as she had ever confronted it, had struck her as embarrassing and extravagantly ugly, like a turkey's waddle. But Ruth was clearly pleased with her own and smitten with Marion's. She treated the little flap as important, central, even deserving of reverence, an idol in a hidden shrine. When the stars aligned, they went out in London with Eddie. ducking into crowded, smoky rooms, loud with jazz and yeasty with spilled liquor, Marion got the same giddy, feral thrill she'd had as a child when embarking on some adventure with Jamie and Caleb. Rambunctious joy heightened by the conspiratorial nature of their triangle. Marion knew Ruth had told Eddie they'd become lovers, something Eddie acknowledged only subtly by directing a welcoming brotherly warmth at Marion. She imagined he must have affairs of his own. How could he watch planes just like his, flown by men he knew, burn and fall and not seek pleasure, release, comfort, life? "Marion saved my life, you know," Ruth said one night in May, arching a dramatic eyebrow as she sipped from her cocktail. They were celebrating Eddie's return from his 15th combat mission. If he survived 25, he could go home. Eddie turned to Marion with mild curiosity. People were saving each other's lives all the time.
"How'd you do that?"
"Don't look at me," Marion said. "I don't know what she's talking about. Yesterday, I was taking a Fairchild from White Waltham to Preston." Ruth cut herself off, reached across the table to touch Eddie's arm, said in a sweet schoolteacher's voice, "You might not know this, Eddie, but to get there, you have to fly through the Liverpool corridor. Do you know what that is?"
Amused, he said, "I'm sure you'll tell me."
"It's a strip of airspace 2.5 miles wide between the Liverpool balloon barrage and the one at Warrington. Anyway, I'd already gone in when out of nowhere, I was in a cloud. Truly, out of nowhere. 1 minute, clear sailing. The next, nothing but white. It turns out it has to do with the dew point, some strange phenomenon."
"Did Marion change the dew point?" Eddie said. "Is she the god of weather?"
"Almost," said Ruth.
"Marion must be the sun, then. She came and burned away the cloud."
"No, but she had taught me a few things about flying on instruments."
"I didn't think you were listening," Marion said.
She turned to Eddie, explained, "She would only let me try to teach her in pubs and was always changing the subject. I barely told her anything. You told me that if I got caught in cloud, I should straighten up, get back on course, turn very slowly and shallowly around to the reciprocal, and then try to dive under.
Anyone could have told you that.
But no one bothered except you. So I did it. But the only problem was that I got down to 500 feet and the mist hadn't thinned at all. So then I thought I'd go over. But the cloud went up forever. I went up to 7,500 feet and I was still in it."
"You should have bailed out," said Eddie.
"I thought about it," Ruth said, "and I might have, except I'd been late to catch the taxi plane and hadn't had time to change into my trousers, so I was wearing my uniform skirt and just between us three, I'd run out of clean undies and wasn't wearing any."
She looked between them.
"You see the problem."
"Ruth," Eddie said, "given the choice between death and gliding down with your unmentionables out, you should have chosen the latter. Actually, I'm almost surprised you didn't relish the opportunity to be a scandal."
"Me too," Ruth said thoughtfully. "In retrospect, I think I didn't want to be so helpless. Anyway, I just flew along, hoping a hole would open up."
"I'm on the edge of my seat," Eddie said, "even though it appears you survived."
"I saw a thinning. Or I thought I did. I might have imagined it. I had no idea where I was. When I dove, I could have been plowing right into the balloons or a hillside."
She stopped talking. Eddie took her hand. "You had the wind up," Eddie said.
"I did. I really did."
Ruth's voice wavered.
"You know, when it's happening, you're concentrating so hard you can't really feel anything. But later, it hits you and it's like you have a chill and can't get warm again."
"Give me a bit of advice, Marion," Eddie said. "Anything, For luck. What do I need to know? What will save my life?
It was only common sense, what I told Ruth.
That's not advice. Come on.
Marion considered. Said, my first flying teacher told me to learn when to ignore my instincts and give in when I wanted to resist, and resist when I wanted to give in. He wasn't really talking about flying, though, and he died not long after in a crash. Eddie laughed.
My strong instinct is to ignore this terrible advice, but maybe that means I should take it. You've given me a conundrum.
A week later, word that Eddie's plane had been shot down. He was classified as missing. Ruth lay on her bed, the telegram discarded on the floor.
His 17th mission,
she said to Marion, who sat stroking her back. How can they expect anyone to survive 25? It's inhumane. You should have seen them look at me when the telegram came. Like I was being rude for crying. Why doesn't anyone cry here?
People are afraid if they start, they'll never stop.
A few days later, when Ruth was delivering a Spitfire, she detoured and landed at Eddie's base, feigning a mechanical problem. In the hangar and the ops room, she badgered anyone she could find for information. Crew members in other planes had reported seeing three parachutes before Eddie's plane exploded, she learned. But no one could know whose they'd been. Pacific Ocean, June 1943, a few weeks later. A troop ship slid under the Golden Gate Bridge, heading to sea. From where Jamie stood at a high railing, the decks looked mossed over with men. A carpet of khaki and green bodies as dense as sod. They didn't know their destination. A piercing evening brightness glanced off the white caps and the wheeling seabirds and the Golden Gate's orange-red towers, one of which was about to be swallowed by a bank of fog pouring down over the Presidio. The water glowed milky jade until the fog caught the ship. Jamie went below. The ship had once been an ocean liner, but all the furnishings and fittings had been removed. In their place, bunks were stacked everywhere, tight as baker's trays. The windows and portholes had been boarded over or painted black. On the decks, where couples might once have strolled arm in arm, heaped up sandbags encircled outdated anti-aircraft guns. It wasn't a new ship, nor fast enough to rely on speed for defense, not like the Queen Mary or Queen Elizabeth. And so a destroyer dogged along with it. The hull and superstructure had been painted gray, effacing the vessel's name on the bow and stern. And it was not until the second day, when he saw some soldiers using an old life ring to keep their dice from rolling away, that Jamie learned the ship's name. Maria Fortuna. He had not thought about the Josephina Eterna's sister ship since he was a child, and Wallace had shown him newspaper clippings about the disaster. In photos, he and Marion had been two bundled, faceless pupae being carried down the gangway of the SS Manaus by their father. There had been stray mentions of Eleanor's other, newer liner, Maria Fortuna, which had only recently gone into service. He walked around the ship, trying to imagine its former splendor. Some merchant seamen had stayed on, and he waylaid an engineer in a corridor below decks. She had a sister ship that sank, didn't she? Jamie asked. The Josephina?
That's right. Bad thing. Before my time, of course.
Soldiers and sailors were squeezing past in both directions.
Better stop holding up traffic.
The engineer said, and was gone, absorbed into the flow. Jamie had been given a few days' leave between the Aleutians and his departure from San Francisco, and when the transport plane from Kodiak unexpectedly stopped in Seattle to refuel, he'd decided, on impulse, to disembark. When he identified himself on the telephone, Sarah Fahey, Sarah Scott, had made a small, indecipherable sound.
"Did you get the watercolor I sent?" he asked. She cleared her throat.
"I did."
He waited for her to say something else. When she didn't, he said, "I didn't mean to bother you. I thought of you because I'm in town, but I'll let you go."
"Yes," she said in a vague voice. "Yes, all right."
He'd gone out and had too many drinks in a bar rowdy with servicemen. The same old bewildered, clutching, yearning feeling rose up in him, like something coming out of the deep, roiling the surface. Why had he called her? Why couldn't he leave well enough alone? If there was one thing he should have learned from their last meeting, it was that she was an illusion, a fantasy, and anything between them was impossible anyway. Seeking her out yet again was the height of foolishness. When he'd made the watercolor of Adax Harbor, it had been one of those golden moments in between storms, the horizon deep indigo while lemony light skittered across the water. Even the ugliest heaps of military junk along the shoreline had been bathed in a heavenly glow, and he'd felt a pressure in his chest, the sublime. As the colors seeped from his brush, he'd been overwhelmed with gratitude to Sarah. She'd goaded him into enlarging his life. Attu hadn't driven away his gratitude, but it complicated it, shot it through with something dark and heavy as iron ore. In the morning, he found a message slipped under his hotel room door. Would he please meet Mrs. Scott for lunch? An hour was given and an address, just down the street. He tried to remember if he'd told her where he was staying, was nearly positive he hadn't. He'd thought, right up until the appointed time, that he wouldn't go. But of course he did. She was waiting at a booth in the back of the dim, grubby diner she'd chosen, out of place in her neat blue suit and pumps, her face tense.
"Nice to see you," he said.
He sat down and began studying the menu.
"Do you already know what you want?"
She reached across the table to touch the back of his hand.
"Jamie, I'm sorry," she said.
He put down the menu. "For what?"
"To start, for the way I was on the phone. I was shocked, and my sister was in the room. I couldn't say anything I needed to say with her there."
A waiter appeared, an older man in a paper hat with a paunch hanging over his stained apron, pen poised above his notepad. "What'll it be?"
"We might need a minute," Jamie said. The guy stuck the pen behind his ear and went away. "Are you actually hungry? We could go somewhere else to talk," Sarah said. "To your hotel?" She blushed. "I chose this place only because it's right nearby." He slid out of the booth at once. She held out her hands. "I may need your help. My knees are shaking."
"How did you find me?" he asked as they walked out, her holding his arm.
"I thought you might stay near the museum, so I worked out from there, calling hotels."
"How many did you call?"
17. They did not talk much more until later, after he had taken off her blue suit and white silk blouse, after he had unclipped her stockings and rolled them down, divested her of her inner casing of girdle and bra and panties. He worked slowly and methodically, stopping her every time she tried to assist or hasten the process. When she was finally naked on the bed, her hair loose on her shoulders, he'd stepped back and looked at her. She'd stared back, and he'd closed his eyes, testing himself, summoning her image, willing himself to remember.
"My brother died,"
she said after, lying in the crook of his arm.
"In the Pacific. I'd only just come out of the worst of it when I got your watercolor. I knew you'd gone, of course. But after Irving died, I realized that if not for me, you might be tucked up safe somewhere." I'd actually tried to shame you.
I suppose that's part of what drives this whole thing, isn't it?
Everybody wants everybody else to suffer as they are.
People wish things on others they never could have imagined. They do things they couldn't have imagined.
When your painting arrived, all I could think was, what have I done?
She lifted her head to look at him.
If not for me, would you have gone?
I think so. You have power over me, but not that much. Don't feel responsible.
She dropped her forehead onto his chest. I wish it were that simple.
Me too.
My husband's in the Mediterranean.
She looked up again fiercely.
I do love him.
I didn't think this meant you didn't.
She settled back down, tugged gently at his chest hair. So blonde, she said. You turned out woolly. I wouldn't have expected.
I'm as surprised as you.
Did you know one of your Alaska paintings was in Life magazine?
Yes, they told me.
Have you seen it? Naked, unembarrassed, she got out of bed and extracted the magazine from her handbag. They leaned against the headboard together, and she flipped to an article about the Aleutians. His painting was of the airfield on Adak, a plane kicking up spray as it landed under an approaching storm. He studied the reproduction.
I never thought I'd be a propagandist.
Is that what they want from you?
No. Surprisingly, no. They've given me almost total freedom. Well, as much freedom as anyone has in the Navy.
He drew her close, rested his chin on top of her head.
This reminds me of when you'd come up to the attic to help me look through the art. It was the most alone I ever felt with you.
We had clothes on then.
I desperately wished we didn't.
Me too.
Really?
Sometimes. I didn't quite know what I wanted.
She was still looking at the magazine.
You get used to thinking of the war happening in black and white because of the photos.
He thought of the Japanese soldiers blowing themselves apart. There are colors.
This painting does something different than a photograph, because you've bent the perspective ever so slightly. It has a feeling that's informative in a different way than strict reality.
Her foot moved against his calf.
It's still your work. It's still you.
He got out of bed, went to his satchel, came back with the sketchbook he'd had on a two. He opened it to a page he'd filled with blotches and scribbles and handed it to her. I made these during the bonsai charge. I thought I was drawing what I was seeing. She turned the pages.
Weren't you?
I mean, when I looked at the paper, I actually saw realistic images. Figures, you know? Scenes. She was quiet. I killed 3 men, he said. He hadn't told anyone before. It would have been strange to tell anyone in the Aleutians. Superfluous. He churned with nerves. Though he was not haunted by the memory of the 3 dead men, he was haunted by the medical tent, the shapes moving under the canvas.
It's a war, Sarah said.
Would you mail this to my sister for me? He asked about the copy of Life. I'd like her to see it. I don't know if I'll have a chance before I'm sent off again. I'll give you her address in England.
She's in England? He told her as best he knew about the ATA and about Marion's years in Alaska, and also, eventually, about Barclay. After a hesitation, Sarah said, I should say that my mother told me about when Marion came here. Not at the time, but recently, after I last saw you.
Don't worry, she would never tell my father. He has no idea about most of what she does. It was a kindness. More than that, she gave Marion a new life.
Yes, I think so, too, now that I understand. I'm embarrassed about how I reacted before, last time, when you said Marion didn't want to have children.
It's all right. I'm embarrassed about some things I said, and also because I didn't find out anything really about your life. Will you tell me now?
I don't know where to start.
Start anywhere.
She told him about her sons, her love for them, but also her sense of being confined by motherhood. She told him she loved her husband, but resented his assumption of her fealty. She told him about her sisters and their families, about Irving's death on Bataan. He told her about how he'd veered toward becoming a drunk, how Marion had taken him to Vancouver, about Judith Wexler and Sally Ayukawa, about going to the mountains and leaving again, about Wallace dying. The afternoon waned. The room grew dim, but they didn't turn on any lights. After they'd dressed, they held each other for a long time by the door, knowing that once they stepped outside, something would be over. He walked with her to the lobby, watched her go out into the evening, her hair still loose. When he checked out of the hotel before he boarded his train for San Francisco, he gave the clerk a paper-wrapped parcel and paid for it to be delivered by courier to Sarah's house. The note, which he'd written on hotel stationery and tucked inside the sketchbook, read, "Technically, this belongs to the United States Navy, and it's not mine to give. But I don't want to send it to Washington, and I don't want to carry it around anymore. Would you keep it for me? Maybe I want to leave something with you so I have an excuse to see you again. Yes, I do. But really, the reason I'll come back is because I love you, and what I've left of myself can never be reclaimed."
Stalag Luft 1, near Barth, Germany. June 1943. Around the same time, Jamie sailed from San Francisco. Leo, when Eddie first saw him, a week after he arrived in camp, was on stage in a gauzy blue dress of dyed, stitched-together handkerchiefs and a brittle wig made from Red Cross packing material, two straw braids tied with twine. He was Gabby in the petrified forest, playing against a set made from Red Cross crates with props bartered from the German guards who had borrowed them from a theater company in town. Thousands of men desperate for distraction made good audiences. The guards came too, sat in the front row.
"A lot of girls I know could learn a thing or two from that,"
the guy next to Eddie whispered, gazing appreciatively at Leo. That. Because what was he? He was obviously not a woman, but also, somehow, he could make himself indistinguishable from one. Some of the guys who played girls, not just in the plays, Eddie learned, but at the camp's oddly earnest dances and teas, too, fully embraced the rituals of womanhood, and shaved their arms and legs, and concocted homemade lipstick and blush. But Leo, with his big beaky nose and hairy arms, only had to put a bit of softness into his joints, a bit of sway into his spine, and a careful flourish into his fingers. And he was a lonely, pretentious, impetuous girl tending a gas station lunchroom in Arizona. Watching, Eddie could almost feel the desert heat, smell the grease of the deep fryer. Eddie started looking for Leo after that. Almost didn't recognize him when they wound up next to each other in the wash shed, despite the nose. "You were great in the play," he ventured. "Were you an actor before?"
"No, I was a bombardier. I mean, before. I knew what you meant. Only in my dreams. I never had the nerve even to audition in high school. But here, why not? What do I have to lose?"
"You were terrific. The guy next to me said real girls could learn something from you."
Leo pressed his lips together,
They like to say that.
I suppose it's all in good fun, Eddie said, cautious.
Leo gave the same brief, polite smile.
Can be.
Desperate times, desperate measures?
For some.
Eddie dropped his voice almost to a whisper.
Poor bastards,
he said. The plane had been shot up by a Messerschmitt. The engine caught fire. The co-pilot and the tail gunner were dead already, shot when the pilot told the rest to hit the silk. The bombardier went out first, through the same bay from which he'd dropped so many bombs. Then the radio man, then Eddie. Strange to plunge through the sky only in his body, without the encapsulation of the plane, falling among the flak and the bullets and the droning engines, the fire. He'd pulled the ripcord. The radio man was shot dead while hanging from his parachute. And Eddie didn't know what happened to the pilot and the other guys. Eddie and the bombardier were taken to Frankfurt to be interrogated. And from there, he was sent to the camp, on the Baltic. As the prisoners walked from the train to the gates, people gathered on the side of the road to jeer at them and mime nooses and firing squads.
I don't understand why it has to be that I'm more a woman than a woman,
Leo said to Eddie a month after they met. They were in Leo's barracks, Leo standing near the stove, and Eddie wedged into a corner among the bunks, as there was nowhere else he could fit himself. The rooms were 16 by 24 and housed 15 men. Leo had a tin cup full of hot water from the laundry, a special favor from one of the guys there, and a sliver of Red Cross soap, and was scrubbing at his makeup. After the match, Lieutenant Bork or Brox or whatever it is, the religious one who won't shut up about being from Pittsburgh, told me there wouldn't have been any call for Eve, like Eve in the garden Eve, if I'd been there. It would have been a different kind of original sin, no doubt, but I think he's confused about a few things. Leo had spent the afternoon sauntering around in a skirt and wig and shirt tied around his ribs, holding up scorecards for a boxing match while hundreds of Kriegies hooted and hollered and shouted lewd suggestions. Eddie said,
I hope someday someone tells Lieutenant Brock how babies are made.
Guys just want to reassure themselves it doesn't mean anything if they think about me while they're spanking it. I'm more woman than a woman, after all. I'm femininity distilled down to its purest, tittiest essence.
I think most of them just miss girls more than they know what to do with.
Fine, but that's not my problem. Do I think they all want to suck my dick? No. Do I think most of them wouldn't turn down getting their dick sucked by me at this point? Well.
He craned his face toward Eddie. Did I get it all?
Eddie dipped his thumb in the water and wiped at the corner of Leo's eye. Just something here. He put his big hand around the back of Leo's head and kissed him. Leo pulled away.
Someone will come in.
Someone always comes in. Leo was, to Eddie's mind, surprisingly shy about their relationship. There were one or two other couples in the camp, real couples, and they were generally tolerated as long as they maintained some semblance of discretion, which was a low bar in a place so crowded. There were other kinds of relationships, too. Paired off straight men as devoted and sexless as old spinsters, for example. Or serious partnerships based entirely around food sharing. There were strictly sexual liaisons between camp queers, between queers and squares, between obliging squares. There were swapped favors of all kinds. All varieties of love. There were murky, confusing friendships that ended in bewilderment or hurt feelings or fist fights.
After the war, Eddie said, the first thing I want to do is find a room. A clean room that doesn't smell like a latrine. It's worse than ever right now, isn't it? said Leo. A clean room with a bed with clean sheets and a door that both locks and unlocks. And I want to spend a whole night with you. I want to be completely naked, and I want to take my time. Leo patted his cheek.
Sounds great.
And the next night, and the night after that. Hamble, England, November 1943, 5 months after Jamie sailed from San Francisco.
A man came looking for you,
one of the other pilots said as Marion sat down in the Hamble mess for lunch. Marion took a bite of Bubble and Squeak. What man? She had gone to White Waltham for a few weeks in September to upgrade to heavy twin engines Class 4, and instead of being sent back to Ratcliffe, she'd been reassigned to Hamble, the all-female number 15 ferry pool, not far from Southampton, near the Vickers Supermarine factories from which Spitfires and twin-engine bombers emerged as steadily as eggs from a hen house. The town was pleasantly quaint. The airfield lay between the River Hamble and Southampton Water, blanketed by industrial smog and surrounded by balloon barrages.
Couldn't say, said the girl. I didn't see him. Nancy did and told me to pass on the message.
Where's Nancy?
I think she was off for Belfast. Apparently, he came by this morning. Must be keen, your fellow.
I don't have a fellow. Did she say anything else? His name?
Let me think.
The girl angled her eyes up to the ceiling, scouring her memory.
No, that's it.
Another pilot greeted them and sat. Marion ate pensively, letting the conversation pass her by. If Ruth were at the table, she would not have allowed Marion to be so unsociable. But Ruth had been summoned to White Waltham just as Marion finished there, and after her upgrade, had been sent back to Ratcliffe. They'd fallen out of sync again, mostly just logistically, though they were also handling their prolonged separation differently. Ruth wrote Marion long letters full of coded longing and more explicit reproach for what she called Marion's stoicism. Marion's replies were brief and unadorned, mostly about the flying. It wasn't that Marion didn't miss Ruth. Rather, she took her missing and sealed it away. Her natural inclination was to carry on, to think of other things. Of course, Ruth was also burdened by worry about Eddie. Word had come eventually that he was alive in a German prisoner of war camp. Then, a Red Cross postcard had come from Eddie himself, saying nothing more than that he was in Stalag Luft 1. After lunch, Cloud came in, and around 3, the meteorological office washed them out for the day. Marion left on her motorbike. Most of the girls in Hamble were billeted in little brick cottages, but Marion preferred the Polygon Hotel in Southampton, 7 miles away. She'd wanted space between herself and the ferry pool, some semblance of privacy. Puttering along toward Southampton, dodging drab green jeeps and trucks full of the Americans who'd been arriving in greater and greater numbers, she wondered if the man who'd come looking for her could have been Jamie. She thought he was in the Pacific, but on the other hand, she hadn't heard from him in more than a month. He'd been in Papua New Guinea when he mailed his last letter, being eaten alive by mosquitoes and rotted by mildew. So much for paradise, he'd written. He seemed to roam freely through the war. Maybe the Navy had decided he was needed in the European theater to chronicle the eventual invasion. All these Americans piling up in Britain, their camps sprawling along the south coast, were surely to be put to use before too long. In midsummer, she'd received Sarah Fahey Scott's manila envelope with the copy of Life Inside, a paper bookmark stuck between the 2 pages taken up by Jamie's painting, and a card with a brief message. We've never met, but I'm an old friend of your brother's, and have heard enough about you to wish we might be friends too. I was so grateful he looked me up when he passed through Seattle last month. He asked me to forward this on. That's his painting in there, being seen by millions. But I'm sure you'd know his work from a mile away. My mother sends her best wishes, by the way. She called you a force, which is her highest praise. Marianne had wondered why Jamie had not told her he'd seen Sarah again, and whether perhaps a letter had been lost. She'd studied the painting. A P-4 landing on some godforsaken speck in the Bering Sea. The subject wasn't his, but the execution was. The slight warp to the perspective, and the sureness with which he'd suggested the clouds, the hovering white crown of a volcano, the reflections on the waterlogged runway. The airplane was well.